Greetings and welcome to the Dynamics of Colorism with your host, Dr. Donna Maria Culbreth. You may call in to share your experiences, colorism, to pose a question, or just to give a general comment. You may do so by dialing area code 914-338-1308. And now, to begin our show, here's Dr. Culbreth. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Dynamics of Colorism for Thursday, May 16th, 2013. I'm your host, Dr. Donna Maria Culbreth, and I'm coming to you live, as we always do, every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Good evening, everyone. Tonight, our topic is genealogy, colorism, and passing, and I'm going to be flying solo tonight. And I found this to be a pretty interesting topic, talking about genealogy and how it's relative to colorism and passing. And what I'm going to do is briefly go over a little historical perspectives of passing, colorism. Then we're going to get into talking about genealogy. And what I'm using tonight to also discuss is the movie The Human Stain, which I found to be an excellent movie. And we'll discuss that and how it's relative to passing. And we'll also look at the implications or actually the problems that can actually result sometimes when people do decide to pass and how it can complicate their lives at times. I am exhausted and worn out this week, gang, so we're going to keep it short and sweet. I'm actually drained. But nonetheless, the show must go on. So let's get into talking about the genealogy. Let's talk about colorism. We're going to talk about passing. When we start talking about passing, it's not always just that somebody's passing for white. It could be that they're passing for another, to be a member of another racial group. And normally in the past, when we refer to passing, we were looking at it, and let's say, keep this in the perspective of looking at Black Americans with colorism and skin color issues and skin color complexes. In the past, we often referred to it, passing among Black people was when you saw that their skin color was very light or in white or in close proximity to whiteness, when they had either the straight hair, looking at the narrow nose or thin lips, basically to the point that it may have actually been impossible to determine if there was any Black ancestry associated with that particular individual. So what we'll do is we'll go back and we'll look at history. And whether we're looking at miscegenation, the time era of manumission when Blacks were actually freed, and how we had issues where the lighter complexion Blacks who could actually pass often changed. They would pass for white, whereas darker skinned Blacks would often change their last names to either Spanish or Portuguese names. So when we start looking at how this passing was an issue, we can start looking like in the Deep South, where the mulattoes were actually treated as a third category, and they were considered like a buffer class between whites and Blacks. So the racial designations then were you have white, mulatto, and then you had Black. Now, before the Civil War, many states actually used what they called the 1/4 or the 1/8 Black indicator, used. The 1/4 of one Black blood is an indication between Black and white. And I covered all of this in another show, and I think it's either under the antebellum era or it's under the show titled Slavery, Manumission. So I'm just going to briefly overview the notes from that show in order to bring us up to speed for today. Now, beginning back in like 1850 and up to 1920, the United States Census actually classified Black Americans into four categories. They have them listed as Black, Mulatto, Quadroon, and Octoroon. And we know that when you start looking at the different names or categories that they associated with people who had Black blood in them, if someone had 3/4 or more African ancestry, They were classified as black. A mulatto was someone who had between 3/8 and 5/8 of African ancestry. A quadroon was someone with 1/4 or less African ancestry. An octoroon was 1/8 or less. So you have all these designations based on, you know, what they consider the amount of black blood that people possessed. Then we get into the 1910s, and then we have the one-drop rule being passed by several states, basically stating if you have one drop of black blood, you're considered black. Now, remember again, after the Civil War, this has actually started happening, and they did this to make sure that blacks, regardless of their skin color, were not able to be considered white. Now, we also had issues in this time era, a little before, where there were several lawsuits that were being filed. And these lawsuits, they were filed toward the end of slavery. And in these suits, blacks, black Americans, were actually filing to be declared white. And this is according to Gross in his article. And the blacks were able to pass. A lot of them were able to actually pass back in those days. And many of them lived as whites, and they socialized with white people. Now, what was interesting to note, and we noted this in the show when we talked about the antebellum era, where in Alabama, there was a significant number of white women who were actually giving birth to mulatto children, and these women were actually married to white men. So when we start looking at this one-drop rule, it was interesting because in South Carolina, they didn't adopt that one-drop rule because it would have destroyed that three-tier hierarchy that they have, white, mulatto, and black. Now, South Carolina actually did not determine status by blood. What they did was that they elevated the free mulattoes as long as they maintain, and this is interesting, everybody, as long as they maintained a good reputation in the community, and it gave them access to white privileges. So mulattoes who were proper acting, they were considered quality, and that was determined by their wealth and education. And some of them were even able to apply for a legal standing as being classified as white. Now, when we start looking in the lower South, there were distinctions within the black population based upon mixed racial heritage and, of course, the skin color. And they were made routinely. It was a constant. It was always going on. And what you find interesting and at the same time disturbing is that skin color differences were indicators of a relative status. Now, of course, we all know that preferential treatment was given to the mulattoes. And it's really interesting to note that some of the mulattoes actually owned slaves in the lower South. And what happened was when the mulattoes were given this preferential treatment and more liberties and opportunities, what it actually did, it began to affect the relationship between black Americans, the darker complexion black Americans, and the mulattoes. Now, and we go back a little bit more and we start looking into history again. As the lighter complexion slaves or freed people began to take on, rather, the upper class, the ways, rather, of upper class white families, they actually began to flaunt their higher social and educational achievements. And, of course, again, this is going to cause tension and it's going to result in problems. So when these tensions begin to escalate within communities of free blacks, it concerned a lot of people, especially the whites. And it was interesting, everyone, because the mere fact that the skin was light, other phenotypes, when you're looking at the hair, the nose, the lips, because they were in close proximity to whiteness or white in general, these mulattoes would actually, and this is in the lower South now, so let me make sure I'm correct here, they actually began to discriminate actively against those who were darker than themselves. And remember, they only want to socialize with other mulattoes. So this, in my opinion, is where we really start seeing a lot of issues with this colorism, skin color biasness, preferential treatment, the belief that they're privileged because of the light skin and phenotypes. This is where we start seeing issues develop. Now, let's try and go fast forward a little bit more and go into the Reconstruction era. These are the years that W.B. Du Bois labeled as the mystic years. We know that skin color issues, you know, light skin, dark skin, mulattoes and blacks continue to exist. And it was really sad in a sense because the skin color differences, I mean, they actually continued, you know, to play an important role within the black community. And it did to such a degree that the elite mulattoes, they were able to actually maintain this privileged status they had acquired during slavery. There were distinctions that they made sure that were very obvious between themselves and the darker skinned masses. And they actually began moving into separate communities where the mulattoes lived like split, and I'm just giving this as an example, may have lived on one side of the town, and darkened complexions lived on the other. And the key to get access to those communities was actually based on the skin color. So now we have these really severe divisions within the black community. They began to sharpen, and it really caused a lot of issues. And this is according to Parks and Woodson, and they wrote that in 2002. Now, it's interesting to note also that Pearson Trommel noted that myths, and this is in quotes, and misperceptions concerning status, class, intelligence, and beauty, they were all based on skin color and certain features such as the broadness of the nose, the thickness of the lips, and the straightness of the hair, end quote. And again, it's Pearson Trommel. She noted that in her research. So now we're down to looking at features and tone being divided into actually two groups, the good and the bad. And what happened was that the good features became synonymous with European characteristics, while the bad features, they began to associate with African characteristics or traits. Again, quoting Parks and Woodson, 2002. So there were various terms that were used to identify the different appearances, the hair, the skin color, lips of people of color. But my issue with all of this, gang, my issue is that what was the deciding factor? Who was actually determining what were considered good features and what were considered bad features? You know, and the biggest issue is that, again, they're going back to using or relying on the European ideology of what is considered a standard of beauty. So we must keep that in mind and remember that during this era, this time period, when we were having these issues among black Americans based on skin color and other phenotypic features, was mainly that all of the standards of beauty of what was considered acceptable or attractive or beautiful, again, based on those European standards in which they just blatantly classify anything associated with dark skin, Afrocentric features as being ugly, bad, unattractive. So now let's take a look at some of the classifications that how they classified some of the skin colors, especially with light skin. Now, the light skin tones, and this is according to Parrish in 1944, were often referred to as fair, bright, or yellow, whereas those with darker complexions would have been called jet black, ink spot, or shine. And I can recall in research and conversations with older family members and just older people in general, where sometimes they refer to a darker complexion black person as blue, referencing their skin as being blue-black. So what happened now was that when they started taking the skin colors and looking at them and giving them classifications and associating them with either negative or positive, you know, the darker tones were considered, you know, aggressive, mean, ugly, and of lower class. And it's interesting to note, even today in the millennium in 2013, when you're looking at people who are not black or not a person of color, stereotyping people from other racial categories, other racial groups, it's always this association of darker complexions or darker skin with lower class being mean, ugly, unattractive. And it's sad because we're still seeing it, and that's a whole other show we'll talk about later on down the road. But it's sad when you start looking at a color hierarchy, you know, where they're actually just saying because you're dark skin, you go to the lower class side. If you're lighter skin, you come to the lighter class side. And what happened, everyone, was that with these issues with the mulattoes, when they moved into these little separate or segregated societies, they even started their social clubs. And during a show back in December of last year, when Dr. Audrey Alyssa Kerr, she is the author of The Paperback Principle, she was a guest on the show. And during that time, we actually talked about these clubs and associations and church memberships that the lighter complexion blacks belong to. We even discussed the skin color test that they used back in that time from, I think, the issues that we talked about, the test rather, whether the everybody knows about the paper bag test, the fingernail test, which I'll talk about in a minute, which is pretty interesting. They had the comb test, the door test. I mean, they used several tests to determine if whether or not someone was black. And with the comb test, you know, they would take the comb and slide it through somebody's hair. And if the comb went through easily, you know, without getting stuck in any kinky hair, okay, you could come in or you'd be accepted. The paper bag test, we know, talked about placing arm inside or next to a brown paper bag. And if you were the color of the bag or lighter, you were accepted. The door test, where they had like a plaque or something hung on the door. And you have to be lighter than that particular color, that color or lighter, in order to gain entrance. And then it was the color tax test. And that test was used, like, if they had parties or events. And if someone bringing a date to the party was a darker complexion, then the person bringing them the date would have to pay a color tax test, like a higher fee. And it's interesting to know when we're talking about that, because a couple of years ago, just I think it was last year, the year before last, there were actually parties going on where they were having light-skinned women could actually enter the party for free or by a certain time for free, and darker complexion women had to pay a higher rate. So, you know, when you start looking at the color tax test, that's an example of that right there, and what's so right in that instance. But what's so sad about it is that when we start seeing these issues happening today in current society, it's really sad because we don't really understand how detrimental they are, and that these skin color complex issues and phenotype ideologies that we're still dealing with in the millennium, it just makes everything really, really bad. I think what we need to understand, people of color, they need to understand that when we start making these distinctions based on skin tone, then there, you know, it really makes us look bad. It's just the bottom line. There's no other way of saying it. It doesn't make sense. It's ridiculous. But let me go back and talk about these tests that we use. Now, the tests that I just mentioned earlier, the fingernail test, color tax, paper bag, comb, those were tests that were actually used by black Americans against other black Americans. What was interesting is that there were tests that were used by white Americans to an attempt to identify if someone was actually black or white, when it's actually difficult to determine their racial category just by looking at them based on their features. So what they did, they had what they were called spotters, who were people who I would assume, and I'm guessing at this one, and you can find more information in Dr. Audrey Alyssa Kerr's book, The Paperback Principle, and in her dissertation, Two Washingtons, where they use a fingernail test. And the fingernail test required them to look at the beds of your nails, and I believe that if they were like a purplish color, knew you automatically, you were black. And if they were not, then they believed that you were white, which is also interesting because when we have later shows, we're also going to talk about these tests again, because it's interesting because I really believe that black Americans actually may have, and this is a may have, developed these actual tests that they used because of the fact that white Americans were using the fingernail test and spotters in a sense to identify who was black and who was not. So, I mean, you never know. That's maybe a little bit far-fetched, but that's just a thought that popped into my head. And I haven't been able to find any additional research, and I'm going to continue conducting research to find out if there's any connection there. So I guess you're probably wondering, how in the heck is Dr. C bringing in genealogy, talking about colorism and passing? Well, I'll share this with you. One of my sidebar hobbies, when I can find the time, which is very rare, I like to do genealogy searches. I like to look back and find my ancestors. So I use Ancestry.com. And I was able to trace my ancestors, back for, I think, 4 or 5 generations. And before I even get into that, let me just say this. You know, from the Reconstruction era until about 1930, children who were born of black and white parents or mixed race parents were usually identified as mulatto or mixed. And you can find that reference in blackhistory.com. But what I did when I was checking through my, checking to find my ancestors, other than the information provided by my family, by my mom and dad, and my Aunt Ruth, Aunt Ruth Dixon, I was able to find on my paternal grandparents, great-great-great-grandparents, all the way back a couple of generations. And it was interesting to note, because I used 1840 census records, and this is why I think it would be a great idea, and I'll go into detail why when I finish explaining what I found, where you can actually, when there are issues or whether someone is questioning whether they were actually mulattoes or mixed race or how our ancestors were actually categorized in the census from years ago, you can actually go back. And if you go into Ancestry.com or whatever resource you decide to use, I prefer Ancestry because I've been with them for years. But if you actually go back through and you look at the census records, when you log in, everybody, and you go there, and let's say you find the name of one of your great-great-grandparents, even your great-grandparents, when you go in and you actually start looking at these census records, when you log in, and I'm going to try and get back into mine while I'm talking to you, but what I was actually able to do, excuse me for moving around, I was able to go in and develop a wonderful family tree going back several generations. But when you log in and you say you find a record from 1840 census and you know your ancestor's name, when you go into Ancestry.com and you type in, you know, their name, as much information as you can get, first name, last name, you want to put in like a city or a state where you believed that they actually lived. When you do that and type it in, it'll actually give you the opportunity to put in like the state they lived in, the ward. Now, my ancestors actually lived in Fernandina Beach, I believe, Florida. And when you type in the information, you can have an option of checking the census records or whatever areas you want to check. But when I went back through the census records, I was able to find out that the information that my mom, and here's the ironic thing, gang, my mother has more information on my dad's relatives than anyone in his family was ever able to give me as far as on my dad's mom's side. So through the help of my mom, Reverend Dr. Ada B. Culbris, I was able to identify my paternal great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents, how they would classify their race. Now, this is interesting to know, and I have it written down, and because every time I would explain it, it gets really confusing, so bear with me, and I think I have it right. But my great-great-grandparents were identified themselves in the census, 1840 records, as being mulatto. Now, my great-great-grandfather, his birthplace was in Spain, and the records show that, you know, he was born in Spain. My great great-grandmother was Indian. And I knew that already from, we have photographs of her. And when I looked this up, it was so interesting because when I went to the census records in the category, in the area where it says race, it was the M there for mulatto. Some were written out with mulatto, some just said M. Even though they claim in historical records that sometimes they were identified as being mulatto or mixed, I was only able to find mulatto. And in instances where it did have the M for other years, I was assuming that that just stood for mulatto itself. So let's get back to my family, how I was able to trace this. Now, my great-great-grandmother was Indian and Spanish, but her racial category in the census was down as mulatto. My great-grandmother, racial category was down as mulatto. My great-grandfather was German and black. My great-grandmother was listed as mulatto. However, my grandmother, their daughter, was identified as black, and we know because of that one-drop rule. But it was interesting to know, because I was wondering, and as I went through all of the records, and I talked to my mom about this right before the show, and what I found interesting is that during this time in history, you know, and based on their appearances, my great-great-grandmother did look as to be Hispanic. She was a teacher in Florida. And I was wondering, I said, you know what, was she able to, you know, obtain her degree, her college degree, and become a teacher because of her skin color being very fair and with her hair texture and her facial features? And I often wondered, and this is something you may start thinking about as you, if you go through and decide to go back and look at your ancestors and consider the fact that with the issues that we were dealing with in the United States, as far as skin color, the one-drop rule, the separatism between light complexion and dark complexion blacks, you know, it makes you wonder, did or could our relatives have possibly benefit? How did they benefit from their skin color with regard to being her being a teacher in Florida and other job opportunities? Now, it's interesting because when I actually started looking at all this data, first of all, it's just phenomenal to do this and go back and look and find names and dates and places, and you match it with the information that your family has given you. You can dig back further. So I was able, everyone, to go back to my great-great-great grandparents and find their sisters and brothers, and then it drops off. I'm not able to find any information about their parents. But the reason why I think this is interesting is because it makes you wonder why their race, number one, was classified as mulatto. Was it because they either used the they went from mulatto or mixed? It also makes you wonder, did any of our ancestors at any point in time try to pass? And it's also interesting because if they classified mixed race people as mulatto or mixed, then you start looking at the passing issue and you're wondering, you know, did they ever pass for not being black? Did they not pass for being Indian or Hispanic or whatever? It's kind of difficult, like, I guess, to explain or look at the data, look at your family history, look at the era in history that we're talking about, based on what we know about colorism and how lighter complexion people were able to have advantages and were privileged over darker complexion. It just makes you wonder. At any point in time, if people did pass, you know, and this is just my little theory that I'm playing around with. You know, did they pass for trying to be white? Could our ancestors have tried to pass for being, let's just say, maybe Indian or Spanish? Was there ever a time in history based, remember again, we have to take everything into consideration. You know, the time, the history, the location, because the South now, you know, what did they actually experience as far as these skin color issues? So you can only try and imagine. And then the more you start talking to family members, you can find more information. But my point in bringing up the genealogy thing issue is that if you're interested in just knowing or looking at your family history, and especially if you come from a mixed-race family, you may want to go back and check and see how your ancestors were actually classified, you know, categorized, rather, during the census, when they reported in for the census. Now, interesting, when my great-grandmother lived in, before she moved to, up from the South, she was classified as a mulatto. However, later on in the census, once she moved up north with my granddad, my great-grandfather, who was German and black, her racial category was then listed as being black. So it's interesting, really interesting to see when you look at each census, the data from each census in this particular time period. When you're doing this, everybody, go back as far as you possibly can with the census data. And you can print this information up. And when you print it up, then you can do a comparison or develop your own little table like in Excel or SPSS or whatever you want to use, even a Microsoft Word table. But go back, and this is what I did, and I found it interesting, and collect all the data you can from your particular family members from the census all the way up until, you know, the last census data entry on Ancestry.com or whatever tool, whatever website that you're using, or even if you go to the databases and look at this information, and then make a table and look and see, you know, say, for example, here's 1840 census data, here's the next one, and each year, look at your particular ancestor's name, look at where they were living at, and look at their racial category. In mine, I found it interesting when we went from mulatto, up until about, I think, 1930 or 40, and the date may have been off because I didn't write that one down. Then the racial category changed to black. So what is Dr. C's point? When you want to really know and you come from a mixed race background, use the census data, because then you can get a better perspective or an understanding as to exactly how your family, your ancestors would classify their race. And then it can help you develop other questions that you may want to ask other family members who are still around. And why I find this interesting is because I'm looking at the colorism issues here. I'm looking at whether or not our ancestors used their skin color to an advantage when necessary. For example, did they pass for job opportunities to live in certain communities or districts? So that is just interesting to know. That also brings me to what I want to talk about in passing. But don't forget, use Ancestry.com or some other tool. Go back, look at the census data. Write down the racial category that your ancestors categorized themselves as in as many census data records as you can possibly find. And just look, because it'd be interesting to note, did at any point in time, did they ever change your racial category from mulatto to black, or was it white and then changed to mulatto, or was it mulatto and changed to white? It is interesting to look at that information and then start asking your family questions, because I think it's just interesting to know about your family history and your background. So genealogy is connected to this colorism issue when you want to try and determine if, in fact, and this is especially true, like if you've heard old family tales where you say, oh, well, so-and-so was married to so-and-so, or this person was Spanish and this person was Indian, and then they married such and such a person. I found it interesting when I looked at my grandmom, who was Indian and Spanish, and my granddad and my great-grandparents, Indian, Spanish, and then German and black. Now, my grandmother, that is my dad's mom, these are her family members. Her race has always been categorized as being black. Now, we go back and we look again, it's because her dad was German and black, her mom was Spanish and Indian. But that one drop of black blood, with that one drop rule, she was never classified as mixed race. She was classified as black. Mind you, her skin color was exactly the same as her. Maybe she's a little tanner, maybe slate. Maybe one or two shades tanner than her mom, who was very, very fair. So it's interesting to look at how genealogy and doing ancestry research can help you identify any type of skin color, or rather colorism issues within the family. And when I'm saying the colorism issues, I'm saying we're looking to see if there were any, at any point in time, distinctions were made within your family. So if you have a family history and somebody's saying, oh, well, your great-great-great-grandfather was very fair-skinned and he passed for white, or he was fair-skinned but he never tried to pass for white, you know, when you want to look and see if there are any colorism issues in there, if they tell you tales where they may say, well, your cousin Joe left his first wife because people didn't like her skin color, you can go back, gang, and look at all of this information. It's time-consuming. I remember one particular time, I think I was on there from 1:30 in the morning until about 4:30 or 5 in the morning. But it's intriguing, it's interesting, and it's so relaxing and soothing to do. So if you have issues and you want to know if there are any skin color biases, issues in your own family, start doing a search. Check out your ancestors. Write down as much information as you can. Save it to give it to your children to pass on and pass on. I actually created a book online, and I was able to actually do this on my dad's side and my mom's side. My mom's family, I think it went back like 3 generations. My dad was 4 or 5. So look at that. And if any of you care to share your result, what you find with me, let me know. I'd be interested to find out if you found any issues where anyone in your family actually tried to pass. If they were black or Asian or Indian or whatever color your family, your racial category may be, and they actually tried to pass for being white or for another racial group. And when we start talking about passing, everyone, that brings me to talking about a couple of movies that I've watched, with the exception of one over the years, in which there were issues where it was a person who actually looked white or in close proximity to white, and they actually did pass. One movie, I remember my dad used to like to watch this movie, was titled Imitation of Life, a 1959 movie in which a brown-skinned black woman had a daughter who looked white, and the daughter actually passed for white and really treated her mother terribly because she didn't want anyone to know that her mother was a black woman. And she believed that she had better opportunities, and I think she was a showgirl, where she actually didn't want her mother to be bothered, did not want to be bothered with her mother because her mother was actually a black woman. And it's interesting to know how she treated her mother so terribly. And toward the end of the movie, when the mother died, halfway through the movie, when a guy found out that she was black, and I think maybe because her mother may have said something to her, he saw her talking to her mother, the guy found out that she was black, and he really beat her up terribly. In the end of the movie, her mother dies, still loving her daughter to death and thinking the world of her daughter, and the daughter comes back to the funeral and they try and pull her away. And she screams and she says, no, you don't understand, that's my mother. And, you know, it's just a very sad, sad ending movie, but it was interesting to watch. And it's so clear of how this daughter, who wanted so much to be white, went to the degree she actually sacrificed a quality or decent relationship with her mother in order to pass. And then again, we have to remember, everyone, with the opportunities and the issues that people who were on that borderline who could pass for white had to deal with. And this goes back to, I think it's Franklin's book, in which he noted that people who were light complexion to the point that they could pass for white, they were not accepted by black Americans because of their skin color and their appearance. And at the same time, if there was an edge or a little inkling that could say, well, you do look like you have black blood in you, they weren't even accepted by whites. So these people were like thrown into this like they say, the second or another category. So they were kind of like feeling, I guess I would assume, like outcasts. You know, they were not, they didn't want to be, some of them did not even want to be associated with being black anyway. Then we have the other movie, The Band of Angels. Now, in this movie, this particular lady did not try and pass, but she was very, I think her father was wealthy. He ended up losing all his money. The daughter realizes then her world just falls apart and shatters because she discovers that her mother was actually a black woman. She didn't know this, so it classified her as being black. So that's another, that's a 1957 movie. I think Clark Gable was in that movie. The other movie, Pinky, was 1949. These are movies my dad always told us about when we were younger, and he actually had videos of these movies. And Pinky was a light-skinned black woman. When she was going to college, I think she was going to nursing school in the northern states, while she was there, she passed for being white. When she returned home, you know, I think she revealed to her grandmom that what she had done. And in the meantime, she fell in love with a young doctor who was white. Who didn't know anything about her black heritage, and then the movie goes on and on. It's an okay movie, but these movies I'm bringing up, everyone, is because they're clearly showing you in these movies where there were skin color issues, where there were black people, or who had black ancestry in them, who were able to pass for being white. Now, the movie where I found the person suffered the most, and there are probably other movies out there, but I just haven't had time to review yet, is the movie The Human Stain. I found the movie extremely interesting to watch. What happened in this particular movie, and this is where we start talking, and this is why I think it's important to be able to go back and look at the ancestry.com, and do these searches and census data and other records. It's also important because in this particular movie, we have a college professor who first passed for white, then he passed for being Jewish in the end. And what happened was that when he was younger, his dad was, I think, a former optician. Optician, that's what his father was. And I think his mom was a nurse, but he was very fair complexion. Now, his mother was tan complexion. You could tell that she was black. You could tell the dad was black, but they were very fair complexion people. The son, however, came out very light. The sister and brother, you know, looked tan. They looked black. But he passed for being white. Then he passed for being Jewish. And what happened is that, and what I'm bringing these up for is to show you how this one individual trying to pass, how it actually destroyed him in the end. And there were repercussions, and he paid the price. There are other issues that were involved in the movie, which I'm not concerned with, which I'm not going to discuss. I'm mainly interested in the fact that here's a professor. He was a professor at a college. And during one of his lectures in the class, he noticed that there were two black students who had not been present in the class. He made a comment, and he asked a statement, and he said, he referred to them as being spooks, S-P-O-O-K-S, and he claimed, you know, with the intention he meant as in ghosts, spooks being ghosts. Well, we all know that when you refer to someone as being a spook, it's racially derogatory, and that's how blacks often refer to a spook. So we got back to these students about his statement, and he was actually brought up on charges by the university, you know, with racially biased comment. And this is something that, and while I'm talking about this, we all must be mindful of what we say and how we say it to people, especially people of color, especially in a work environment. Because, and I'm going to use this case again when we talk about colorism and racism in the workplace, because unconscious biasness can really cause problems. And there are a lot of times in situations where people who are not people of color can make statements, comments, whether it's in writing or to someone's face, that are racially stereotypical, they are offensive, and they are biased. And what's so sad about it is because a lot of times, people who are not people of color, they don't understand it. They don't get it. And they think there's nothing wrong with them making comments or saying statements. Just like in this situation with this professor here, Coleman Silk, when he made the comment and said, "What are they, spooks?" His reference was to ghosts, as so he claimed. Whereas it was interpreted, and it because of the longstanding stereotypical and racial connotations associated with the term spooks, it was just inappropriate. He used the wrong language, the wrong term, according to the school, and they, you know, they really got on him about it. He resigned. My point, everybody, is this. Here's a black man who has passed for being white, and then he later decided to pass as being Jewish, who made a comment about the skin color, about two black students and referred to them as being spooks. In his mind, he saw nothing wrong with that. And this is an issue that we see every day with issues in work environments where people don't understand that if you make a statement about a person of color, that is something that can that has been historically interpreted as being racially insensitive, a racially stereotyped comment, you have a major issue. And this is why it's important for employers to have diversity training in the work environment. This is why it is important for employers to understand and be sensitive and mindful of how they word and phrase statements. And if it happens to you, you need to address it with the supervisors, your superiors, and get it to HR. And if need be, take it to the EEOC. Because if you can go back, and this is, I can tell you this from experience, and explain it to someone who's not a person of color, sometimes they don't get it. They don't think there's anything wrong with what they said or what they wrote because they have not experienced racism as a person of color. They have not been racially stereotyped as a person of color. And many of them are not aware of how detrimental racially stereotyped comments are and how they affect people. And there must be training, and this is why it's important for employers to understand you need to train your employers. You can have a vice president of an organization who is just so insensitive and unaware, and sometimes they unconsciously say and do these things, and sometimes they intentionally do it. The bottom line of it is that if you're ever victimized by this, you need to speak up on it. Don't just sit there and say, "Oh, I can't believe they said this or did this." You stand your ground and you push back with it. Because if you don't, that type of behavior will continue. And this is why we see so many issues in the work environment where there is a definite need for sensitivity training. So people learn what they should and should not say, how to be careful when phrasing their statements that they're making, especially about a person of color. And I can say this to you, then I'm going to move on. But historically, when I was conducting investigations, there was always issues where I had investigated cases where several professional, very strong, very intelligent, highly educated black women were being told by their non-white superiors about their tones. And I found it myself offensive to even think that anyone would put that in writing. And when you're conducting investigations, and I've been doing HR consulting and into the racial discriminatory practices and conscious and unconscious bias issues for a long time. And what I found interesting is that simple comments, words, and statements, a person, when they make them, they have to be mindful of who they're making them to or writing them about. And if they are offensive or racially insensitive or racially stereotypical, then employees have every right to talk to bring it, take it back to them and demand that they apologize or remove it. And if they do not, then you take it to the EEOC. In this particular situation with Coleman Silk, this professor, now remember, this is a black man who for years has passed as being Jewish. He disassociated himself with his family. When he decided that he was going to pass and he told his mother, it broke her heart. And he basically just said, I don't want any association with you. And when he got married, he married a white woman, or I think she was Jewish also. And they had children. All of his children came out, with the fair skin. There was no indication of them being black. He never told his wife. He never told his children. Toward the end of the movie, after he dies, he gets killed. At his funeral, one of the black professors at the school then, acknowledged what happened was wrong and to reinstate his good name. But the sad part of it is that his sister then appeared at the funeral, who he hadn't seen it, known it if they had not been in contact for years. And she went on to tell the person who wrote the book, author of the book, that the guy was black, how he chose to pass. But my point in talking about this particular movie, everyone, is that this gentleman made a conscious decision that he wanted to pass to be of a different racial category. And he paid the price for that with his career. When these allegations surfaced, or when the issue blew up in his face of him referring to two black students as being spooks, had he at that time revealed that he was in fact a black man, there may not have been such a controversy behind his statement. However, when you're looking at it from issues involving racism, his use of the word spook, that is what got him in trouble. And it got him in trouble because of the fact that it's a Jewish man calling two black kids spooks in the middle of a college classroom. Even despite the fact that he stated he meant ghosts, it is what it is. And remember, people's perceptions, that person's, your perception is your reality. So in the whole scheme of things, we have a black man who looks white, passed for Jewish, denied his heritage, denied any association with his black family members. His entire career was in shambles because of that decision. And what I found interesting, everybody, had he admitted that he was a black man, it would have gone away probably, or would not have been as severe or as intense as it was. But if, and this is where the colorism issue comes into play. However, and let me get some water. If those two students had been darker complexion students, and he still admitted, and he admitted that I am a black man after all of these years, if he came forward and said that, the mere fact that, let's just, imagine this. If they were dark complexion, he's light complexion, it could have been a colorism issue. They could have said, that he made a distinction based on our skin tone. Now, mind you, we don't know the skin color of these two particular students. But if they were dark complexion and he's very fair, and he said, yes, I am a black man, there still may have been an issue raised where you have a light skin versus dark skin issue. It could have easily been classified as being a colorism issue, where he's making a distinction based on the skin tone of these two students who may have been dark complexion. It would have been an issue. So when we start looking at colorism, we start looking at passing. This is how I'm bringing in the genealogy portion now. This is why I discussed it earlier. Back in this particular era when this happened, this is, I think, about 1996. I think Ancestry may have been around then, I'm not sure. But had someone been able to go back in and just do a check for their ancestors, even his children, if some of his children had decided to do that. But the key thing here is that he had told his family, I think his wife and his children, that his parents and all his relatives were dead and all photographs and everything had been destroyed. And I think that he said that he was a Russian Jewish person. I think that is what he classified himself as. Let me double check. He did. He said that his grandparents and great-grandparents were Russian Jews. and they were all dead, and all their worldly belongings, including any type of photo albums, pictures, little trinket mementos, all of that information had been destroyed somehow. So it's interesting to note, when we start looking at the human stain, not only are we looking at an issue of colorism, we're looking at the issue of passing, black man passing for being white and then passing for Jewish. Then we're also looking at the possibility that had he revealed to the world that he was a black man, we're looking at the possibility if those two students were darker complexion, it could have been a possible colorism issue to deal with. What is my point? My point is this. Sometimes when you're looking at colorism, it isn't always blatant right in your face, just like racism. You have the overt and covert. Colorism can also exist in situations where sometimes it's hard to actually see it and identify it. And this is why it's important. I really believe it's important, especially in the work environment, for employees to make sure that they have diversity training. And in that diversity training, they talk about colorism. They talk about the skin color issues. They talk about making distinctions based on someone's skin color and their features. You know, you're looking at the noses, the hair, eyes, lips. This is all important. And what I've had, I think it was maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, a conversation with my new business partner in our new consulting firm, and I'll tell you about that in a few minutes. We were talking about it because we actually do human resource management consulting, management, and educational consulting. And ladies and gentlemen, when I tell you I think I've seen it all with issues in the workplace, that's a book that has to be written. I've seen it all. And it's amazing because sometimes when I'm thinking back and I'm saying, my gosh, or I'm just going through my files, it's amazing if some of the issues that I've dealt with as far as investigations and consulting issues, but it's important for employers to make sure that they're including these discussions. And here's the reason why. If an employee make, like this guy Silk in this particular movie, The Human Stain, made what he believes is an innocent comment, even though he should have known better, that's common sense, and maybe it was part of him that still identified with being black, thinking it was okay to say spooks. That's another issue we have to consider, too. But this is why it's important for training, sensitivity training, diversity training. Talk about colorism in the work environment because it happens every day. And failing to talk about it is not going to make the issue not happen in the work environment. It's a possibility that it can. But when you have employees who are aware, they can think before they speak. They can be a little bit more considerate, understand other cultures, understand the values of other cultures, understand belief systems. It's important when we start talking about this because it's like President Obama has stated, in the United States, we've never addressed the complexities of race in this country. And, you know, we need to do that. We need to talk about the issues and the concerns that we still deal with. You know, we all see what the president is going through as a black man. So when you start looking at work environments, whether it's in a store, it's in a car dealership, in the post office, any type of environment, racism and colorism and other type of stereotypes, prejudices, they exist. However, if you are victimized by any of these and you don't speak on it, then shame on you. Because by not speaking on it, by not taking a stand, you are sending the message or you're letting people think it's okay. And that is why that behavior continues. One of my dear friends, Professor Evans, has always stated that people treat you the way they do because you allow it. If you don't allow someone to treat you a certain way, then they cannot. So when we start talking about colorism issues, even if it's a good friend of yours in the workplace or just a friend in general, makes a comment about someone's skin color being light or dark, and it's a negative comment or you find it offensive, you need to speak on it at that point in time. See, this is how we start the process of trying to heal and trying to eradicate it. Simple little innuendos, little snide jokes, little comments. These are all issues that you may think are okay and there's nothing wrong with it, but the other person may find it highly offensive. And their perceptions are is actually that person's reality. So at the end of the day, when all is said and done, when we start talking about colorism, remember this issue of the human stain. If those two students had been darker complexion students and he even admitted that he was a black man, it could have still been an issue where they could have stated that he made that distinction and referred to them as spooks because they were dark complexion individuals. Because he decided to hide his racial identity and continue to pass as being a Jewish man as opposed to letting the world know he is really a black man, he paid the piper in the end. In the movie The Imitation of Life, we saw the same issue. The bottom line of it is that whether people pass or not, I'm not concerned with that. I'm concerned with people understanding that comments and statements based on skin color, behaviors, actions, if you think it and you say it, then shame on you. You have to be aware and you have to be careful that there are certain statements, comments, jokes that are just not acceptable. Let's say, for example, if you're a light complexion person and you have a friend who's dark complexion and they're always calling you a yellow monkey or old yaller, you may laugh it off when you're younger, but as you get older, you may become a little bit more sensitive to it and you may not like it and it may bother you. Them making that distinction, even though it's all in fun, it's still colorism. It doesn't change from being colorism because your best friend or your cousin or your sister's boyfriend or your friend said it to you. Colorism is colorism. It's a distinction based on a skin tone. And let's do vice versa. If you are a lighter complexion person calling your darker complexion friend, you know, blackie or negative names associated with the color of his skin, it's the same thing. Regardless of what racial category you're in, people of color suffer from the effects of colorism. And it's interesting to notice, we noted last week with Dr. Horch Freeman, is that when you start talking about colorism, it's interesting to know how it affects people of color by the racial group. There's some similarities and there's some instances where they're not similar. But the harmful effects of colorism, we'll put it this way, it's detrimental. So having said that, that's my take on this genealogy, colorism, and passing. And I tried to reach out to someone who's an expert in genealogy, and I wasn't able to get a response. So I'm going to look for another person to talk more about this genealogy, colorism thing, and passing at another show. So that's my take on the show for tonight, everyone. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope it was enlightening and educating and informative. You get a chance, try and look up some ancestry records of your family members and see what you find. I think I stated this earlier anyway, in the case of Coleman Silk, this particular professor, had any of his family members been able to go to a site like this, to Ancestry or somewhere else, and look him up? You never know, they may have found him and discovered that he was in fact a black man. Okay, everyone, that's my take. Hope you enjoyed it. I'll give you a few announcements and updates. Oh, first, what I do want to say is congratulations to Ralph Ministries on the 11th year anniversary this year. Congratulations, Pastor Ralph, and I wish you many, many more. I think that's just wonderful. With regard to our website, I am going to be updating the website soon, everyone. I've been so extremely busy. I normally try and get to the Colorism Project on the weekends, and I just haven't had the time. I've just been so exhausted. So I will get to the website and continue to get it updated. All our projects and everything is still going on. We're making significant progress. I also like to announce that I have, with a good friend of mine, Professor Evans, we have merged. Originally, I held, I was the president of Culbreth Educational, Culbreth and Associates, which was an educational consulting firm geared toward providing consulting services from the pre-K all the way through college level. And I was also the managing partner of Giovanni Ellis, which was a management and human resource management consulting firm. And what Professor Evans and I have done, we merged our firms together to form Culbreth Evans and Associates. And our new website is culbrethandevans.com. I think I have it up and going. So we're excited about our new partnership. We are a limited liability company, and we are both managing partners in the firm and in the consulting firm, and we look forward to continuing business as usual for my clients. I did send out notices to you, but in case you missed them, Culbreth Educational Associates and Giovanni Management is now Culbreth Evans and Associates. So, everyone, that's all I have for you for tonight. It's been pretty good. I think our next show, May 23rd, or maybe, believe it's May 30th, we will have Dr. Petra Robinson on, where we will discuss colorism in the Jamaican community and discuss how colorism and skin bleaching issues affect Jamaicans. And our regular list of shows will be updated on the website. Okay, everyone, I'm tired. Time for me to get some rest. It's been a wonderful show. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope it was informative. Looking forward to seeing you next week. Have a good evening, everyone. Good night. Thank you for tuning in to The Dynamics of Colorism with your host, Dr. Donna Maria Culbreth. You may contact Dr. Culbreth at 1-800-905-2136. You may email your questions to drculbreth@colorismproject.com. We're looking forward to you tuning in next Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Until then, remember, dare to be different and dream in color. This is Dr. Culbreth, signing off for the Dynamics of Colorism. Good night, everyone.